Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Now we live in a more dangerous world, and therefore we need a stronger and more, even more united NATO, and that's exactly what this summit has delivered.
A historic shift. The man at the center, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, joins me. Then,
America's better positioned to lead the world than we ever have been.
U.S. Senator and President Biden's close confidant, Chris Coons, joins us from the Madrid summit. And
several of the most conservative judges in the entire country are sitting on the Supreme Court. And that's a very unusual situation.
A transformed U.S. Supreme Court. Columbia law professor Jamal Green tells Hari Srinivasan why the current system is no way to protect a democracy. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. NATO leaders are hailing the Madrid summit as a victory for the alliance. United in purpose, the allies are set to welcome two new members and significantly beef up the deterrent posture in Europe. President Joe Biden said he had warned his Russian counterpart that this would happen.
Before the war started, I told Putin that if he invaded Ukraine, NATO would not only get stronger, but would get more united. And he would see democracies in the world stand up and oppose his aggression and defend the rules-based order. And that's exactly what we're seeing today.
Now, while the shift is undoubtedly historic, the real test for the alliance is in Ukraine, where Russia continues to encircle and pound cities in the Donbass region. Today, though, there was a Ukrainian victory on the strategically significant Snake Island, demonstrating the country's fierce determination and resolve. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has been key to getting members across the finish line, and I reached him in Madrid just as the summit wrapped up. Secretary General, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So look, you must be doing a victory lap. You have a whole new strategic doctrine. You've got a whole enlarged NATO, and you've got a much more beefed up deterrent posture with the extra hundreds of thousands of troops pledged. So is this a victory lap that you can do as NATO right now?
It is a victory for NATO that we once again have demonstrated our unity and our ability to change, adapt when the world is changing. And now we live in a more dangerous world, and therefore we need a stronger and more, even more united NATO. And that's exactly what this summit has delivered.
Do you believe, because, you know, up until now, it's been a threat and a promise that if one square inch of NATO territory was challenged by Putin or anybody else, that there would be a swift reaction? Do you believe that NATO countries are much safer now than they were before this summit?
They are safer in a more dangerous world because we live in a world where we see brutal use of force against close neighbor of NATO, a close partner of NATO, Ukraine. And that's the reason why we have significantly stepped up and further will step up our presence in the eastern part of the alliance to remove any room for miscalculation or misunderstanding in Moscow about our readiness to protect and defend all allies. This is deterrence, and the purpose of deterrence is to prevent conflict. And that's exactly what NATO has done for more than 70 years, prevent conflict and preserve peace.
So I guess the proof of the pudding, the way that this is being played out, is in Ukraine right now. So as you know, because Western and Ukrainian officials are observing that Russia is moving much more weaponry and many more troops to the eastern part of Ukraine. If you look at the reports in the newspapers, Ukraine doesn't even have the radio communications it needs on the eastern flank to actually succeed, much less the long-range heavy artillery, the precision missiles, and weaponry that it needs, despite the pledges. Do you not think, as the Swedish Prime Minister said to me yesterday, that this is a moment for NATO to escalate and deliver what it's promised to Ukraine in order for you to match the reality of your rhetoric?
At this summit, we agreed a new assistance package for Ukraine, comprehensive assistance package, and also long-term support. And we also heard allies making new announcements, also for long-range rocket systems, artillery, and so on, to be delivered to Ukraine as quickly as possible. So NATO allies have delivered unprecedented level of military support, and they fully understand the need to continue to make sure that more support gets in as quickly as possible. So this is one of the main messages from this message, from this summit, and also President Zelensky addressed the summit, and the message from allies was that, yes, we are ready to support Ukraine, step up, and we are prepared for long haul.
Of course, he asked in his message for a lot more of the kind of message of the weapons that we're talking about. You know, let me just ask you, you've all said that Putin has made a miscalculation, and maybe indeed in the greater strategic atmosphere he has, he's seen an enlarged NATO. But he's doing what Putin does. He's waging a war of attrition that he's actually seems to be winning in the East. What is it going to take to deliver on what the British foreign minister, for instance, said today, that the aim of NATO is to push Russia back, even from the territory it captured in 2014? At this point, is that realistic, Mr. Secretary General? Do you believe the NATO governments are still adhering to that goal?
Our aim is in many ways twofold. We have to provide support to our close partner, Ukraine, to ensure that Ukraine prevails as an independent sovereign nation in Europe, a neighbor of NATO. And our second and core task is, of course, to prevent escalation of the conflict beyond Ukraine, because the damage, the suffering, the death we see in Ukraine today can be even worse if this escalates into full-fledged war between Russia and NATO. So therefore, support, more support, fast deliveries as quickly as possible, but also at the same time ensure that this doesn't escalate to a full-fledged war. That are the two tasks of NATO in this conflict.
Mm-hmm. And again, the test is in Ukraine. We understand, we've listened to you all, including the Americans, say that the goal is to weaken Russia so that it cannot do what you've just suggested. And it will only happen, as you all know, if they feel pain on the battlefield. I want to ask you whether you're convinced, hand on heart, that there isn't Ukraine fatigue within some member states. You yourself have warned it against Ukraine fatigue. I notice that you, when you speak in your public statements, you talk not just about the strategic necessity of doing everything possible for as long as Ukraine wants, as you said, but also the moral duty to do that. Do you believe that everybody feels the same way?
That was the clear message from this summit, with all the leaders from 30 NATO allied countries and also partners present, Finland and Sweden, but also other partners, is that they are ready to stand by Ukraine, to provide support to Ukraine for as long as it takes. I think these meetings are important just to convey that message, to reinforce the message and to support each other, knowing that this, of course, also have consequences and for us, and that we are paying a price for this war. But the price we are paying is something you can measure in money. The price the Ukrainians are paying is something you measure in lives. They are paying with their lives, and that's a totally different price. And second, the price we are paying by supporting Ukraine is much lower than the price we'll pay if we don't support them, because then we really risk to reward Putin for the use of force, and that will not only be bad for Ukrainians, but it will also undermine our own security. So we are there to help Ukraine in solidarity with them, but also to ensure our own security.
So do you feel you have to sometimes light a bit of a fire under some of the governments? I mean, you've done an exceptional job of this unity, of getting Finland and Sweden in, of getting Turkey to lift its veto. But again, governments like France, like Germany, have been slow to match delivery to what they've promised. And even Lithuania, as you know better than I do, very worried up there in the Baltics about, for instance, France and what Macron has said, the president, about reintegrating eventually Russia into the strategic, you know, security of Europe. The Lithuanians have said, you know, that this is dangerous. They're very worried. It scares me that it will destroy the unity of the EU. That's the foreign minister of Lithuania. Do you see any risk there?
I think we all have a responsibility, and I feel a particular responsibility to rally, to mobilize support. Immediate support to speed up the deliveries to Ukraine, but also to convey this message that wars are unpredictable. So we need to be prepared for the long haul, not believing that this just ends in a couple of months. And again, that's the reason why I think it's important that NATO allies and partners meet to mobilize that support again and again and again, knowing then that the cost of inaction is much higher than the cost of action in providing support to Ukraine.
Secretary General, how do you assess President Putin's latest public demonstrations of confidence? He has now left the country for the first time since this war started. He's gone and given speeches where he's again comparing himself to Peter the Great, the first Tsar of modern Russia. He appears, according to analysts, to have quote-unquote factored in the rules of the game, and that he thinks that he's sitting there and he'll just outwait you all and outfire you all and out-artillery the Ukrainians and get, you know, as much as he can. How do you assess Putin's demeanor and calculations right now?
So I will assess him on his actions, and what he does in Ukraine is a brutal violation of international law. It's a war that has led to a lot of civilian casualties. Civilians are killed and huge losses. At the same time, he has made a big mistake because he totally underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian armed forces, the courage of the Ukrainian political leadership and the Ukrainian people. And he also underestimated the unity of NATO and partners in providing support to Ukraine. And then one of his main messages at the beginning of this war was that he wanted less NATO. He actually proposed for NATO to sign an agreement to have no further NATO enlargement. What he's getting now is more NATO and two new NATO members, including Finland, with a border that is 1,300 kilometers long with Russia, doubling NATO's border with Russia. So he has made a big and huge mistake. That doesn't mean that we don't see the seriousness and the difficulties Ukraine is facing, especially in Donbas, and also the need for us to do even more to ensure that Ukraine prevails as a sovereign nation.
You talk about Sweden and Finland. You were in the room helping to negotiate Turkey lifting its veto. How difficult was that? And are you convinced that you didn't buy in or cave to demands by Turkey that might be unacceptable to certain populations?
So this agreement was something we reached after hard work over several weeks. There were two meetings in Brussels with high officials convened under my auspices in Brussels. And then the only way to find a final solution was to meet with all the leaders, the Prime Minister of Sweden, the President of Finland, and President Erdogan, and me. And together with our closest advisors, we spent many hours in one room negotiating the text. And at the end of that meeting, we had a text. And I'm extremely grateful to Finland, to Sweden, and also to President Erdogan for the flexibility and the constructive approach that enabled us to find this agreement, which is important for Finland and Sweden. It's important for NATO, and it demonstrates that NATO's door is open. President Putin tried to close NATO's door. We have demonstrated that he didn't succeed. NATO's door remains open.
And what about China, Mr. Secretary General? You spoke about China. It's not an adversary, but nonetheless, you said, you know, it has to be considered in this context. And China today has said that NATO is a Cold War remnant and all of this stuff coming out of the summit is just sort of saber rattling. What do you say to China, and what's the most important challenge that they present to NATO right now?
In the current strategic concept that we agreed in NATO in 2010, China is not mentioned with a single word. In the strategic concept we actually agreed yesterday, so the concept we have now, we devote a lot of language to China because China's increasing economic military power matters for our security. China is investing heavily in new long-range nuclear-capable weapon systems. They are trying to control critical infrastructure in our own countries. They're coming closer to us in the Arctic, in Africa, and also in Europe. And China doesn't share our values. We see how they crack down on democratic protests in Hong Kong, throughout their own country, minorities in China, and also how they actually impede, for instance, freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. All of this matters for our security. And therefore, NATO allies have now agreed a strategic concept that reflects how we are going to respond to that changing world and more global competition posed by the rise of China.
Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The summit comes at a trying time for President Biden and his party. The historic growth in NATO strengthens. It's paired with a historic Supreme Court ruling that has reversed American women's rights, a development that U.S. allies have been openly voicing concerns about. Joining me now from the Madrid summit is Chris Coons. He's the Democratic senator from Delaware, and he's also one of Biden's close confidants. So, Senator Coons, welcome back to our program. Let me first ask you to react to what the Secretary General of NATO told me, that not only is this a historic shift, but NATO nations are today safer in a more dangerous world. Do you agree?
I do, Christian. I'm part of a 7-member bipartisan delegation. We spent a day in Finland and a day in Sweden before coming here to the Madrid NATO summit. And one of the many meetings we had in those two countries was a meeting to be briefed on their military and technical capabilities. They're among the two most innovative economies in the world. Critical telecommunications companies like Nokia and Ericsson are headquartered there, and they have very capable militaries. So NATO isn't just getting two new members with this expansion. It's also getting a very capable Navy, Army, and Air Force on our northernmost flank of NATO, which reinforces the Baltic states and reinforces total NATO security. I think this was a very successful summit and a terrific outcome for diplomacy by President Biden and his administration.
So President Biden has talked also about enhancing America's military posture out in Europe, a new headquarters in Poland, and other such things. There's some controversy and some lack of clarity about what we had been told early in the week, that there was a pledge to position some 300,000 more NATO troops, you know, as a deterrent to Russia. Can you tell us as much as you know about that?
Well, I don't know the details about a potential deployment of hundreds of thousands. We did meet with President Biden for over an hour today and with Secretary Austin, our Secretary of Defense, as well as our National Security Advisor, Sullivan. And we did talk about President Biden's significant commitment to forward deploy, for example, two additional naval destroyers here in Spain at Rota, additional F-35s in the United Kingdom, as you've mentioned in your previous interview, to establish a 5th Corps headquarters in Poland. The United States has roughly 100,000 troops on the continent today, and there will be a mixture of heel-to-toe rotational deployments ongoing on the eastern flank of NATO and additional investments. We've had robust support in the Senate, bipartisan support, for additional requests for appropriations for military aid to Ukraine and for humanitarian relief and for additional support for our military. As you know, Christian, earlier this year, on a strong bipartisan basis, we approved a $40 billion supplemental Ukraine appropriations request. And I'm going home from this summit clear that we're going to need to provide additional support for NATO deployments and for the Ukrainians who are fighting so fiercely and so bravely to push back on Putin's unprovoked aggression against Ukraine.
So talking about President Putin, in response to what's come out of the NATO summit, he has responded that this is destabilizing. He said if military contingents and military infrastructure were deployed there, we would be obliged to respond symmetrically to raise the same threats for those territories where threats have arisen for us. How seriously do you take that? And do you still worry, after all of this show of unity by NATO and this strength, that Putin is still a threat to NATO nations?
Well, Putin is, of course, a threat. He has one of the largest nuclear arsenals in the world. He has a sophisticated military, although they have performed poorly in the initial stages of the war in Ukraine. They are now showing what brutality they are capable of, the strike against a shopping mall, the massacre of innocent civilians, the filtration camps, which they have set up to forcibly relocate Ukrainians into Russia. He continues to show his willingness to use his military capabilities. So we have to take him seriously. But frankly, he has blustered and threatened and bluffed over and over in the more than 100 days of his war in Ukraine so far. And I think one of his core goals was to prevent the expansion of NATO, to achieve the Finlandization, if you will, of Ukraine and of the Eastern Front of NATO. And instead, what he's gotten is the addition of Sweden and Finland to NATO and the most unified Western bloc I've seen in my lifetime. We had meeting after meeting after meeting with foreign ministers, prime ministers, defense ministers from more than a dozen countries. And I've never seen the kind of unity of purpose, shared sense of values and a vision and of determination as I've heard here at this NATO summit. Partly that is a credit to President Biden's diplomacy, but partly that's a credit to the unifying force of Putin's unchecked aggression in Ukraine and the urgency of pushing back on that aggression, having seen just how brutal he's capable of being.
So the flip side of that then, Senator, is what if a Trump or a Trump-like figure gets into power at some time in the future? You remember Trump famously called NATO obsolete, and many believe that had he been reelected, he might have pulled the United States out of NATO. Are you concerned that that's a risk down the line? And have you heard from allies that they too are concerned? Yes, they have your leadership now, but what happens in the future?
Well, Christian, populism is a rising political force in many countries. There are right-wing populist, MAGA, if you will, parties throughout Western Europe, Northern Europe, as well as in the United States. And so, of course, this is a concern. There were recent elections in other countries here in Europe where the candidate that came in second or third might well have taken the same sort of position as you're ascribing to our former President Donald Trump. And clearly the January 6th hearings have been going on while we've been here, and that continues to raise the specter both of what he nearly accomplished on January 6th as well as what might happen if he were elected again. I'll simply share this. On the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, on which I serve, we recently took up a bill that would prevent the president, any president of the United States, from unilaterally withdrawing our country from NATO. It passed our committee 21-1 and is something that I think we should take up and pass. There is no question about President Biden's commitment to NATO and support for our North Atlantic treaty commitments. But I think it's important for us to take this action and reassure our European partners and allies that we are committed. Certainly the bipartisan delegation I'm a part of in every meeting and conversation has shown strong and unified determination to support the accession of Finland and Sweden to NATO, to support the Ukrainians in their important conflict, their struggle against Russia, and to support NATO. Our challenge will be to ensure that that continues going forward after the fall elections in the United States.
I want to get back in a moment to whether the U.S. and NATO has an actual plan envisioned for how this war could end. But first, I want to ask you to detail a little bit more what you've been hearing from partners about the threat to American democracy. You just mentioned the January 6th hearings. President Biden was asked in his press conference about the Supreme Court decision reversing women's rights in the United States, asked about the filibuster and the like. Let's just play what the president said about that issue in the press conference.
The one thing that has been destabilizing is the outrageous behavior of the Supreme Court of the United States.
an overruling, not only Roe v. Wade, but essentially challenging the right to privacy. We've been a leader in the world in terms of personal rights and privacy rights, and it is a mistake, in my view, for the Supreme Court to do what it did.
So first I want to ask you about what he made some news there in terms of talking about the filibuster. Can you tell us where that might lead and what you think about that?
Well, I think the position of all the currently serving senators is clear. We have taken a vote on changing the rules of the Senate to end the filibuster. It was not successful. We don't have 50 Democrats committed to that. And so, frankly, I think what the president was commenting on was the most recent decisions of the Supreme Court, ways in which they have turned aside decades of precedent that protects a woman's right to access reproductive health care. I share the president's views on this. But frankly, this hasn't been a topic of discussion within our bipartisan delegation. We've really been focused on NATO, on America's role in providing security for Europe and support for Ukraine and support for the accession of Finland and Sweden to NATO. I do think it's important for us to take seriously the concerns of our partners and allies about our democracy, just as we take seriously concerns about their democracies. And if we link arms and if we continue to support each other, our security, our vibrancy, our openness as societies in the face of challenges from countries like Russia, like China in the world, then in the end, we will show that American democracy is resilient and strong.
Well, to that to that point, I have spoken to several of the world leaders at the summit. Your allies, the Prime Minister of Sweden, of Spain, the head of the EU, Ursula von der Leyen, when she was at the G7 summit, and all of them expressed deep concern about reversing women's rights in the United States. And they're very, very worried and sad in their words. So I want to ask you, what you the effect you think that has on America's standing in the world and on your ability to promote the kind of rights that America stands for, not just women's rights, but the rights of privacy, as the president said. America has been a leader on that issue, privacy and freedoms.
Well, Christian, there was another decision by the Supreme Court today, reining in the power of our administration, of the Environmental Protection Agency, to contribute to our work to promote a cleaner economy, to combat climate change. These issues, the alignment between the United States and our European partners and allies on values issues like privacy, on values issues like our shared concern about climate, are areas where our Supreme Court is moving not just backwards, not just in the wrong direction with regards to our own national interests and priorities, but putting us somewhat more at odds with the rest of the community of open and democratic societies that we have so long been closely aligned with. So this is a concern for me. It's a concern for many Democrats in the United States, how this positions us in the world. But we're going to need to work through this in the months and years ahead through future elections. The current conservative activist Supreme Court majority is the result of a decades-long organized campaign by conservative elements in the United States. It will not be changed or reversed suddenly or abruptly, and it will lead to some real challenges in terms of how the rest of the world sees us and our protection of core values like privacy.
Just let's get back to Ukraine then. The president announced, I think it was $800 million more U.S. dollars, having already sent over at least $7 billion, he said, and also so much weaponry. We do know that not enough of that high-powered, heavy artillery, precision kind of weaponry that the Ukrainians need against Russia in the east has yet got there. But nonetheless, I want to ask you about that, particularly whether you think that there is some kind of rising debate within the administration about how this should end, about, Ukraine's ability to recapture its territory. White House officials this week telling CNN that they're losing confidence that Ukraine will be able to win back all of its territory. Reports that perhaps the Biden administration is thinking of trying to get Zelensky to adjust what victory actually looks like and means. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. That's something that was specifically discussed in our meetings with Secretary Blinken, Secretary Austin, with the president. Our delegation repeated concerns that have been reported about the timing and the delivery and the training, and I was substantially reassured by the clarity, the focus, the purposefulness that we heard from the president and from all of his senior team, first about training of Ukrainian troops, the speed and effectiveness with which they are being trained on the latest systems that are being delivered. Second, on the commitment of some of our core partners and allies, the Germans, the British, others, to also provide advanced systems, heavy weapons, very capable artillery systems known as MLRS or HIMARS, our acronym for them. And then last, the dedication that our administration is showing to replenish, to resupply our own inventory and stocks, the stocks of some of our vital allies who are providing a key partnership and support here. So it seems clear to me from our meetings that we continue to have a shared bipartisan view that it is up to the Ukrainians to decide when and how to negotiate an end to this conflict, what their stance should be, and that in the meantime, we will continue to provide them with resources, support, training, and advanced systems that will allow them to push back on Russian aggression.
And just lastly on that issue, we've all been hearing about the political strains now in many nations, of course, with the war creating more inflation and the energy spikes and all the things that, that citizens are rightly concerned about right now. Many have said, like the Swedish Prime Minister, the Estonian, the Baltics leaders and others, that this surely, plus everything you've said about the risk of Putinism and the risk of winning, makes the case for escalating and really beefing up aid to Ukraine to make this war come to a much more rapid conclusion. That's the only way to keep populations on side.
I agree with that. I think that there is significant public pressure on governments throughout Europe and in North America because of the rising costs of groceries, of energy, and the impact of inflation. In each country, the populace seems to think it is the problem of the leadership of that country, but this is a common challenge across the entire West. The price of oil on global markets, the inflationary impact of this war, the combination of our rapid recovery from the pandemic, which added some inflationary pressures, and the high cost of energy, which is a direct result of Putin's aggression and the impact on food prices because of Putin's aggression against Ukraine, one of the world's largest producers of wheat and sunflower and other critical foodstuffs. All of this is something that was foreseeable, but we made an important choice together as the West, as NATO, to support Ukraine, to stand up to Putin, to impose crippling sanctions. He underestimated the determination of the West to prevent a fundamental shift in the security architecture of our world, to allow him to just roll over a sovereign democratic country that in no way provoked his assault. So Putin must give up this fiction he has that Ukraine is not a real nation, that it's not entitled to exist, and that he can, with impunity, wipe out Ukrainian traditions and people and culture in the parts of the country that he's invaded and is occupying. So this is a cost, a burden that I think our publics are struggling to accept and to bear. And that is one of the reasons why providing more support for Ukraine's military is urgent. I am leaving Madrid, and the meetings we've had are reassured in Western unity to continue these sanctions, to continue supporting Ukraine and in the importance of this mission. If we allow Putin to win, I think he will continue. I think he will simply go after other countries. We met with the Prime Minister of Georgia, who made that point very directly to us. We've also heard similar input from the Baltic states, from Moldova, and from other eastern flank countries such as Poland. So I think this is an urgent and a critical moment where the West is being tested and where President Biden and the American administration is showing that we are a key part of NATO's resolve to push back on Putin's aggression.
Senator Chris Coons, thank you so much for joining us from Madrid. And as the senator mentioned, this divisive Supreme Court has in fact ended its season in typical divisive style. That 6-3 decision by conservatives to strike at the EPA's ability to limit poisonous emissions. The White House says this is another devastating decision from the court that aims to take our country backwards. Now, after reversing Roe versus Wade while loosening gun laws in New York, it looks more like a political body than an independent judiciary, say experts like Jamal Green. He is a Columbia Law School professor and he's author of How Rights Went Wrong. He talks to Hari Srinivasan about the high stakes of America's constitutional conflict.
Christiane, thanks. Professor Jamal Green, thanks for joining us. First, right now, every Supreme Court decision seems to boil down to fundamental rights. So what happens when I have a right and I take you to court because you say you have a competing right and we decide that there's a winner and a loser? I mean, is there an in-between? Should there be?
Well, I certainly think there should be an in-between, and I think courts have at least implicitly understood that there should be an in-between. The fact of the matter is we live in a society in which we're pluralistic. We have very different views. We're diverse from each other. We have different values and commitments. And so the idea that you can just sort of take our competing rights and decide the Constitution believes in one of those rights but doesn't believe in the other is not consistent with the kind of society that we live in. And I think you're seeing that in the polarization that we see is everything gets kind of dialed up to 10 instead of trying to figure out ways of reconciling our competing rights. You know, saying that people have a right to go to the government to try to protect themselves from gun violence and also a right to own guns is something that has to be reconciled. It's not something that where you just pick one or the other, because that denies either the agency and the self-government of one side or the rights and the dignity of the other. And we've got to learn to have those things coexist.
You know, the originalists, the folks who really believe that we should be interpreting the text of the Constitution as close to what the founders would have wanted it, they're going to say this is how the framers actually designed it. But you argued in your book last year that this was not the design.
No, that's a very narrow view of what the framers had in mind, even. And I don't count myself among originalists, but even on an originalist view of how you think about rights, the framers believed in what would have once been called the state police power, that the state has the power to pursue the general welfare, to pass laws for health and safety. And that's totally consistent with the idea that we have rights. Someone has to decide whether the state goes too far, so the state can't do whatever it wants. But when you have very important interests on one side, but also basic rights to self-government on the other, judges have a role to play in trying to figure out where the balance is between those things. And sometimes you have to work that out over time. The framers fully understood that. But we've come to a place where the court doesn't believe that. And so you end up awarding victory to one side and really ratcheting the stakes of politics up very high, rather than working out over time where that reconciliation between our rights should be.
So what is the effect then? If the Supreme Court is either perceived to be or is a political body, what does that do to the balance of power that the framers intended, how we have methods to redress?
Viewing the court as a political body is, I think, in some ways necessary because the court makes political decisions. So the court makes decisions that help to govern us. And that, in that sense, they are political. What the problem comes in when the court's decisions are perceived as being partisan, perceived as being holding water for one side or the other, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. And when that happens, you really have a court that's simply serving the one side or the other in a partisan battle. The American people are not going to tolerate that for very long. We have other institutions that engage in partisan fights. And I really think the court is sacrificing some of its own legitimacy when it's perceived in this way. We all have different views. Judges have different views than each other. I have different views than the court. You and I no doubt have different views about how to understand our rights, how to understand the Constitution. But it's exactly for that reason that the role of the courts should be, and for a long time has been, to lower the stakes of our political conflicts rather than to raise them, to not to align one side or the other in a partisan fight, with what the Constitution requires, because that at that point, the other side loses their stake in the constitutional project. And that's not very good for the health of a nation.
So just this past week, we had a couple of cases that seemed to sort of pull against each other. On the one hand, you had the gun rights case that where the Supreme Court kind of decided to overturn some of the power that a local jurisdiction could have in the case of New York. And then the next day, you had the abortion case where it was almost the opposite, that let's kick this back down to the states.
Well, you have a situation where if you only look at these cases through the lens of is the legislature the decider or is the court the decider, it looks like the court is doing something very different in each of these cases. And you'll get criticism of the court accusing it of hypocrisy, and you'll get criticism the other way saying, well, of course, if you say that it should come out the other way, you're also being a hypocrite of some in some sense. But what I think you're really seeing is a court kind of toggling between two extremes, because it doesn't believe or seems to not believe that there is some reconciliation between values that are on either side of a conflict. So in the gun control case, there's a conflict between public safety and a conflict between gun rights. And the court awards the answer to the gun rights side. And in the abortion conflict, there's a conflict between the potential life of an embryo and the rights of pregnant people to control their reproductive freedom. And the court essentially says there can't be a right on the side of the pregnant person because there's a value in fetal life. That hasn't been the law of abortion for almost half a century to Roe versus Wade. That what hasn't been the law of gun control for hundreds of years of our existence. We work these things out over time through politics, also through court decisions. This is how we govern ourselves, through a combination of political decisions and decisions by courts. What you're seeing here is the court stepping in and deciding that one side or the other is going to get total victory. And that's a very dangerous thing in a democracy.
What did you learn from reading the opinions, both of Alito and the concurrent opinion of Thomas? And Thomas went further than Alito, saying that the court should revisit things like contraception and same-sex marriage.
Well, the Dobbs decision, that's the abortion case, really goes much farther than any opinion has ever been written about this subject. And that includes the dissenting opinions in Roe versus Wade. Those dissenting opinions said that Roe versus Wade goes too far. And that's not an uncommon view, even among people on the left. But the idea that the alternative to that is that there is simply no constitutional value at all in the ability of women, the right of women to control their whether they become parents or not, is an extreme position. There's no way around that. And it's really, if you look around the world, if you look at our particular history, it's a startling denial of significant constitutional values. And again, you can say that you have problems with Roe versus Wade, you think it goes too far, but to go entirely in the other direction is to deny women agency over their lives. In the gun control case, you also had what I think is a startling suggestion on the part of, not just suggestion, but it's the law now on the part of the majority, that public safety has no relevance to whether a gun control measure is constitutional or not. The only question is whether it's a traditional way in which guns have been regulated or not. Again, that's a startling a denial of agency and self-government to the American people of today.
We also had a couple of cases that from the outside seemed to blur the lines between the separation of church and state. We had one ruling where tuition assistance programs in Maine need to also be able to fund religious schools. And then earlier this week, we had a case where a high school football coach was, in fact, according to the Supreme Court, within his right of free speech to exercise prayer on the 50-yard line after high school football games. And the school district was found violating his rights. When I'm looking at this from the outside, am I saying, wait a minute here, is there a risk of either any one religion or religion creeping into matters of how we collectively hold ourselves?
Potentially, yes, the court is certainly giving more leeway to what the majority views as the religious freedom of particular people. These are quite complicated issues in the sense that the Constitution has both a free exercise clause that gives religious freedom to individuals, but also an establishment clause that says that the state should be basically be out of the business of religion. Those are sometimes very difficult to reconcile when you're talking about, in one sense, in one case, a public employee, a public school teacher, and in another case, a public tuition assistance program. What I think you're seeing is a court that is very reliably on one side of the political spectrum, pushing its advantage very aggressively. We're going to have lots of disagreements as a people about how to balance the establishment clause and the free exercise clause. And I don't perceive the court as doing something especially radical in those cases, but I do think that you're seeing the result of a 6-3 very conservative court where the Supreme Court is arguably the several of the most conservative judges in the entire country are sitting on the Supreme Court. And that's a very unusual situation and really does shape our perception of the court as being a political or partisan institution.
You know, and I wonder, some of the critics push back and say, would these cases have turned out differently if the religion at the center of that prayer wasn't Christianity?
Well, I won't speculate about what the court would do if we were talking about another religion. There are cases in which the Supreme Court, including the court's conservative majority, have upheld the rights of Muslim prisoners, for example, or people on death row who are not necessarily Christian. I will say that in general, when courts give give leeway for people to do things like engage in school prayer at a public school, the result of that, given where we are as a country, is that people who practice more popular religions are going to have the leeway to practice those religions, and people who practice less popular religions may not have that leeway. So the person going to the 50-yard line and praying to Allah or engaged in a Hindu prayer of some kind is not going to get the same reception from the audience. And so that's why you don't see that happening, right? So in some sense, by default, you end up privileging one religion or another. But I won't speculate on what I think the court itself might do in that case.
Should any single individual have this much power in a lifetime appointment that's an unelected role?
Well, you're seeing people ask those kinds of questions in ways in which they haven't in the past. I think exactly for the reason that the court is so reliably on one side of the political spectrum, so seems to be carrying the briefcase of the Republican Party. If you look around the world, the idea of a life tenured Supreme Court or high court is extremely rare. The only other country in the world that has a life tenured Supreme Court is Iceland. Every other country in the world either has a retirement age or has term limits. We also have a very small Supreme Court, and our Supreme Court also hears all of its cases, what's called in bank. So at the same time, all of the justices hear all of the cases. And that what that means is that the law becomes extremely individualized and personalized, where in every case you have your justice in the middle. And what does Kavanaugh think? What does Roberts think? Becomes the question, as opposed to what is the law? Have a much more impersonal approach to the law in many other countries. Again, I think it's not very healthy for a democracy. It feels almost like a monarchy when you have a very small set of individuals with life tenure deciding extremely important questions central to our values, central to self-governance, and doing it over 30 or 40 years, and then deciding the timing of their retirement so they can pick the ideology of their replacement. That is no way to conduct a democracy. And if we were starting from scratch, there's no way we would do it this way.
You take time in your book and you point out that other countries do this very differently. I mean, you talk about, for example, abortions exist in Germany. How do they solve this situation? How do they balance these rights, or how do they mediate through these solutions?
Well, it's very ironic in that the German Constitutional Court, and it's not alone in doing this, in when it comes to abortion rights, they had a very controversial abortion case back in the 1970s, just as we did in the United States with Roe. They had a very controversial abortion case in the early 1990s, just as we did with a case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And the German Constitutional Court insisted then and insists now that the value of fetal life is a constitutional value. So in the United States, that codes as an extremely conservative position and would suggest that abortion not only can be regulated by the state, but maybe must be regulated by the state. But in Germany, what that meant was that there has to be some reconciliation between the value of fetal life on the one hand and the conceded value of women to control their destiny on the other. What that's led to in Germany is political negotiation around what it takes to make abortion a meaningful choice for people, which ends up redounding to the benefit both of women trying to choose how to structure their lives, but also fetal life. So how do you choose, how do you encourage people to choose life? Well, you give them social support, you give them paid leave, you give them paid childcare, you give them employment guarantees. That's where the political negotiation has happened in Germany. And I don't think I need to say that that's a more healthy thing to negotiate about politically than to see who can take people's rights away as quickly as possible. There are other ways of thinking about rights where courts force people to the table, force people to negotiate. Don't just hand a victory to one side or the other, and you can end up in a much more healthy place.
Professor Jamal Green, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, in that increasingly divided Supreme Court, a torch is passed. Moments ago, 51-year-old Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first black woman appointee, was sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts and the outgoing Justice Stephen Breyer.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice.
That I will administer justice
without respect to persons.
Without respect to persons.
And do equal right.
And do equal right
to the poor and to the rich.
To the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
And that I will faithfully and impartially
discharge and perform.
Discharge and perform
all the duties.
All the duties
incumbent upon me.
Incumbent upon me.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
As an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Under the Constitution.
Under the Constitution.
And laws of the United States.
And laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
And now, on behalf of all of the members of the court, I am pleased to welcome Justice Jackson to the court and to our common calling.
A liberal appeals court judge and former public defender, Justice Jackson joins a bench in turmoil, as we've been discussing. Yet her addition also means that four women will simultaneously serve on the court for the first time in its 233-year history. Jackson takes the seat of the 83-year-old Breyer. During his 27 years on the bench, Breyer was a steadfast supporter of abortion rights, the environment, and healthcare coverage. His legacy is also one of collegiality. Even as the divisions all around deepened, he often looked for compromise, as he told me last September before announcing his retirement.
When the public that elects the senators and the congressmen comes to the conclusion that they want to see less fighting and more agreement, that will happen. That the senators and members of Congress ask the questions and take the actions that they think, by and large, their constituents want. And so when I'm talking to the college students, I say, my friends, I learned from Senator Kennedy one thing that I think is important, and maybe more, but at least one, and that is listen to people who disagree with you. And if you listen long enough, you'll find on something they agree with you. And then when you get that, you say, let's work with that. Let's work with it. And you work with it and try to produce something positive, something that maybe gives you 30% of what you want, but better 30% than 100% of nothing.
What a radical thought. Compromise to get things done. You can see the full interview at amanpour.com. And coming up tomorrow, with Xi Jinping visiting Hong Kong on the 25th anniversary of the British handover, a closer look at the Chinese leader's rollback of its freedoms and democracy. Britain's last governor there, Chris Patton, tells me about Xi and Beijing's broken promises.
I think one of the reasons why he's been so ruthlessly tough on Hong Kong is that Hong Kong represents a political and intellectual challenge to the notion that Chinese communist central control will rule forever and be a very attractive thing for the rest of the world, which is, of course, nuts.
And we'll have much more on Friday's show. But that's it for now. And if you ever miss our show, you can find the latest episode shortly after it airs on our podcast. On your screen now is a QR code. All you need to do is pick up your phone and scan it with your camera. You can also find it at cnn.com/podcast and on all major platforms. Just search Amanpour. And remember, you can always catch us online, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.